Hey, it's Elisa Monjadas, Managing Director of Stories Bureau, and this is my co-host, Creative Director of Stories Bureau.
Hey, everyone, I'm Corey Grushka, and this is B2B Creatively, where we want to talk about all things B2B creative, from trends to best practices, campaigns that succeeded.
So that all of us together can learn how to be creatively.
If you're a marketer, you'll learn how to be more creative, and if you're a creative, we're going to make you more strategic.
So my personal thesis is that the world of sales and marketing has changed pretty dramatically in the last, let's say, 25 years, and that we're still living in a paradigm, especially when it comes to creativity and brand and marketing in B2B, that is an outdated one, an old one. So my question to you is, I'm going to read the question, right? So what if the problem isn't that B2B tech is hard to make interesting, but that there hasn't been a need to make it interesting? And then the question is, have the conventions on marketing and sales shifted in a way that makes creativity a different priority today? I think you know what my answer is, but what's your take on that?
Okay, so have the conventions of marketing shifted, and has it caused like a change in the output? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. My thesis again is that creativity in the B2B space, in the technology space, B2B marketing space, has not been at a premium, right? It's been content, design, creative has not been the, like, quality of content has not been the priority. To me, it's shifting. And the reason is because the landscape of marketing and sales has shifted in and of itself. Do you agree? I guess. What's your take
on
that?
My take is that the yes and no, I think it's more the people are shifting more than the industry, because maybe this is one of your points, like the way we consume information is so different and the way we interact with each other is also very different. And it's constantly evolving. So it makes sense that marketing and B2B would evolve with the people and technology.
Okay.
And I think that good marketing, it caters to the people more. And that's a shift in philosophy that I think we've seen over the last, I don't know, several years.
In B2B.
In B2B.
Why?
Because before, like, the reason we're in business is because people want something different. And they don't want just, I don't, you know, I'm like also backpedaling because I think there's a huge market that just wants to like click and buy something and not have to talk to people. And the marketing might go back to being basic in the future. I don't know. But there's this, like, with the surge of social media and the way we all consume information, just take video, for example. Video is still blowing up. It's not going away anytime soon. I don't even think video is fully utilized in B2B. But before, we didn't even have the capability of utilizing video. And now we do. And we expect it. So it's like the people have different expectations and needs.
For sure. So the consumption patterns for sure have changed, right? There's no question, mm-hmm. right? Like, people aren't, you know, reading direct mail. You can't, like, you know, the cold calling is, you know, do people even have phones at their offices? Do they even have offices anymore, right? Trade shows, like all of the
door-to-door sales, like I'm not getting people knocking on my door selling me anything, even though that's business to consumer, but
relationships have moved online, right? For sure. So that's different. Mm-hmm. But that's different both for B2C and B2B, right?
Yeah.
I think one thing that stayed the same also is, like, every customer, the customer value is very high in B2B compared to B2C. Selling a $2 pack of gum is a different thing than selling
than like $1 million contract.
Yeah, $1 million contract. So that hasn't changed. But to me, what's changed is the way the nature of the, like, marketer or salesperson in B2B has changed from a gatekeeper of information to a curator or an advisor, right? Like truly to an advisor.
I think that's only true in like more innovative companies, because even just using the word gatekeeper makes me think of all the gated content that's out there. Like marketers want you to submit your information and want you to show intent really early. But then there's like when we talk about developer marketing, for example, which we do a lot of now, developers don't want that. They're just like, tell me what you're going to tell me and don't take me through a journey. Just like give it all to me and let me do things my way. But I don't think all companies are set up like that for marketing.
I think even the concept of gated content, I see obviously the value and the value for
but it's,
to qualify
guess,
a lead,
80%.
And to track a lead. And it's still happening a ton. But that is a bit of an like even
it's
though
old school.
It's old school. Right. And it's
but it's prevalent. I don't know if other people think it's old school, or maybe there's still a lot of old school marketers out there.
To me, today is about, especially if you have a product that you actually believe in, which not everybody does, it's about building community. It really is about like connection with an audience, building a brand. Like to me, gated content is an example of the old school content when your customers have imperfect information, you know, like they don't know, they can't compare you to five competitors and see like full pricing on especially the higher price point B2B stuff. They don't have information to compare all of the features, all of the benefits, all of the disadvantages and pricing and everything, right? The consultation on integration of the product. How hard is this going to be to integrate? Is this going to get through? What is IT going to say about this product? You know what I mean? Like you have, even before AI, which is a whole other conversation, your customer was way more empowered 5-10 years ago than it was 25 years ago when a lot of these frameworks were built, you know, like a lot of these conventions on marketing were built. And now with AI, I mean, like leaving aside, do you even need salespeople in 5 years? Today, like you have a very informed customer that like, why would they give you an email for a white paper that they can have written in 30
seconds? They can have access, they
seconds,
can access that anywhere.
Custom for them,
yeah.
You know? So to me, a lot of it has to do with the lack of information, or how imperfect the information that your customer has. And the priority is to, you have to differentiate with other things. You have to be, you know, like if they don't need you to have a coffee or to meet or to have a Zoom or to get them like a breakdown of features or whatnot, or walk you through how, like what the onboarding process is. They have all that. To me, what we're heading in is an explosion of content, is a place where, you know, like you don't have to be a gatekeeper of information. You can't be a gatekeeper of information anymore. You have to be a, you know, like B2C learned to me probably 20 years ago with social media that they can't just speak to their consumers. Like, you know, in the 50s, there was a few channels. You told them whatever bullshit you wanted to tell them and they just eat it up. I feel like mm-hmm. in the 2000s and 2010s, brands started to understand
now
in B2C
you're building
that
a relationship. It's
a
two
conversation.
Ways.
You have branded content. You have brand documentaries. You're engaging with your consumers. You're building an audience. You're building a community. All that stuff in B2C. I feel like that's where we're now in B2B. And I think it's because part of it for sure has to do with the way we're communicating and the social nature and then engaging nature. I think part of it has to do with the difference of how informed your customer is these days. You have to differentiate in different ways, in my mind, anyway. There's a lot
and
more to this,
obviously. Your brand is now, like, forced to have a personality, whereas if you think about, like, marketing, and I don't know what B2B marketing was like in the 50s. I'm curious.
Right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Probably trade shows. Probably some, like, fledgling trade shows. Every industry probably had like one big trade show or something like that, you know?
And door-to-door sales, but like to offices,
yeah,
you know,
maybe
like someone coming to,
should ask ChatGPT,
like,
right,
here,
now.
buy this paper for your office, something like that. But I think brands are expected to have like a full ethos now, where before it was like, what are you selling? Do I need it? And now there's so much with like globalization and competition. You have to stand out from the rest of your competition. And you philosophically and psychologically, I think we've changed. Like, we don't want just the, like before, I guess, if you had a relationship, you feel like, oh, we connect on a lot of things. Like, we, therefore, I trust you. But now it's more like, do I trust your whole brand? I mean, you see, that's, I wonder if there were even like boycotts in the 50s. You know, would you boy? I mean, I guess that sounds dumb because there were a ton of boycotts, but boycotting business to business, you know? Whenever I think about tension in B2B, I always think sales versus marketing. It's a tension you and I have even in our business, right? Like, I'm like, marketing, we need to tell a story. We need to tell a long story. We need to play the long game. We need to like introduce people to us. And that's why we have Chris Silvestri as our guest today, from Italy through to the UK. Chris, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Chris Silvestri, the Conversion Alchemist. I'm a copywriter, also messaging strategist, and I help B2B software companies, typically Series A to C, so in growth stage, help them stand out because they're somehow lost in the noise. And so I kind of help them make their value impossible to ignore. And I use kind of a mix of approach of copy, user experience design, and the decision-making psychology that's behind it. And obviously, as you mentioned, AI, which I love going into and nerd on.
Chris, I'm curious to know what was an engagement for you? Where do you come in historically before AI into the kind of marketing funnel and working with these companies, and how has it changed?
Yeah, so I would say it hasn't changed my process and it mostly changed my workflow, and it made it more efficient, and it allowed me to scale as well, just because it's only myself and my junior copywriter and my agency, like very small. I still love doing the craft, so no plans on expanding for now. So AI definitely allowed me to scale everything, but still maintain the same, if not better, quality, which is amazing, I think. And as far as my process and where AI comes into play, so typically my clients need, maybe they're going through market shifts or new competitors popped up, or they need to reposition their whole product or their website and relaunch it. So I typically work on positioning strategy, messaging strategy, and the copywriting. And AI comes into play in every single stage, from the research, which I always say is 70% of the work for me, to the strategy and finalizing kind of the messaging documents, value proposition, all of that. And finally,
70% of the work, and now it's probably 90% AI at this point, right?
I mean. Exactly. Actually, and we can jump into it. Yes, definitely AI has a big part, but what I'm kind of adamant on saying is that, yes, AI can do great work, but only if you start with human data, human research, and that's why I'm huge into still grounding AI into real human context, and then from there taking it forward and expanding and scaling. But yeah, so definitely the research big in analyzing, synthesizing lots of data. The strategy allows me to take all of that massive data and condense it into strategic documents. And then the actual writing, which is what a lot of copywriters say it doesn't work, or it writes like crap, I can actually get 80-85% good first drafts with AI. Then I can jump in and edit myself. And I can do it at scale, because if you use certain apps, tools with APIs, you can share your chats with collaborators, and you can actually use the same voice and tone, same exact guidelines, and everyone can basically write from the same standpoint.
Do you offer AI guidelines as part of your packages, like brand, like voice?
Yeah. So for me, my process, the voice guidelines are part of the messaging framework. So my messaging framework document. It's quite a big document that typically includes the market category definition, includes different variations of sales pitches, the strategic narrative, the key messaging pillars framed in different approaches, so gain, pain, logical, emotional, and then the value proposition canvas, which is a separate document that expands on the messaging framework for different personas. And finally, at the end, also the brand voice and guidelines, which I find are super useful for AI, because when I share that document with an LLM, you can take all that context and actually use it to write that good copy as a first draft.
Now, when you said it starts with human insights, or however you framed it, what are you referring to? Are you talking about actual like qualitative research, or are you talking about just a human being doing research that's desktop or whatever, or both?
Yeah, both actually. So I typically think of research I think of it as an iceberg. So the first layer is kind of the surface layer. And to me, that's all the stuff that you can find online. So like reviews, both of your competitors, both your reviews, or maybe you already have support chat transcripts or anything, or sales recordings inside the company that you can readily access. All of that is kind of the surface data and tells you how users or prospects speak, what kind of language they use, that you can totally take it, mirror it, and use it for your copy. Then the second layer,
you get
to
sales
me,
recordings a lot. Is that a request that you make, and how open are the companies to provide that to you?
Yeah, totally.
That's an amazing tool, and especially if you can synthesize with AI.
Remember, Corey, we made this, we had to do a big pitch, and we had to record it and send it instead of having a meeting with them.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to like transcribe our pitch to see what our tone is, and then, send it to
Chris.
Totally. Sometimes maybe the company doesn't have a lot of customers yet to be able to conduct real like customer interviews, the sales recordings, they typically have them if they are sales led. And so they are super, super powerful to access and just scan through. We use AI, obviously, to analyze and kind of get some of the language, the objections that they come up with. Super, super helpful. And companies are more than willing to share them.
It really helps define product market fit also nicely.
Yeah, as well. Yeah.
Chris, you said that I read somewhere that you had said good copy starts with empathy, not cleverness. So how do you train AI to think empathetically?
Yeah, so to me, that all starts obviously with good research. So kind of those layers that I was saying, the first layer, then the kind of, to me, that's the UX layer. So I also like to instruct AI on how people use a website, for example. So after analyze things like usability testing or heat maps or user recordings, I take my notes and then I use AI. I feed those to the AI as well. So it also knows how people interact on the website, what kind of sections they value more or less, where they get stuck. All of that stuff is super useful, I think. And then the final layer is more the qualitative. So customer interviews, surveys, qualitative surveys I'm talking about. So all of that data, the 10, 20 transcripts of interviews, I share it all with AI. And that, I think, gives the LLM a very good direction for kind of shape an archetype or several different archetypes of different customer personas, that the more data you share, obviously, the better and more precise they are. Because online, you can find platforms called synthetic research, right? But a lot of these platforms, what they do kind of wrong, I think, and they mostly work for B2C, because B2B is kind of more niche and it's hard to get personas, realistic B2B personas. Those platforms basically access the whole of the internet. And from there, they kind of try and extract your B2B persona. If you actually have a starting point with real research, that's the kind of direction that they lack. And that really helps the AI put itself in your customer shoes and be kind of empathetic. So after I kind of fed all the material to the AI, which I call the preparation, the next stage is kind of the articulation. So what I do is create these personas. That's just a simple prompt, because now LLM don't really need to be you don't really need to use, I think, huge, massive mega prompts anymore. Simple prompt.
It's gotten better, right?
Yeah, yeah, way better. Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. And it's really good as well at staying in character, like not breaking character when you instruct it to wear the shoes of your customer persona. And so I basically literally create my customer persona or several personas if I have a buying committee. And with those, I can actually go into testing. So I can see, I can ask them questions, I can present them with pieces of copy and do A-B testing. Once I even A-B tested an entire email sequence with different personas, ask them to give me scores for different emails. And
so you'll basically train like a custom GPT or whatever, like on another app, to be the voice of a particular persona.
Yeah.
And then you're just testing messaging against that individual persona.
Yeah, I like using LLMs that have huge context windows, like Gemini is pretty good because it's, I think, 2 million tokens. And so you can share a lot of information. ChatGPT lately has gotten bigger, but still I think it struggles when you share all those massive documents and transcripts.
The interface to train it also kind of sucked.
For clients, like Gemini has privacy that like ChatGPT doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put a bunch of interviews into Gemini. It was so helpful with synthesizing because I couldn't do it for, because it was like private information. It's both, you know, how you manipulate the information with the LLM and then, you know, what it produces. It's a partnership.
Yeah.
Chris, what's your philosophy on persona development? Like when you go into, so you're working with, you said like A to C, or you said later in the, what did you say?
Yeah, typically A to C. So growth stage. Rarely startups over
A to C. Yeah.
Yeah, especially because like a startup, they're not going to have that data that you need. And then, they're going to want to move way faster because even using AI, which is so fast, we have experience with either really large companies or startups too small who don't want to take the time for like qualitative work, especially.
Which
you're in the sweet spot.
Yeah, which I think in that case for like a small startup, that's probably a case where you could benefit from synthetic research, even if you don't have a lot of real data, at least get started and get to a 70% accuracy.
Which but you couldn't do without AI. Sorry, Corey.
Yeah. Right.
I'm like all excited.
No. Keep going. Which you couldn't do without AI. Yeah, easily, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But so what is your philosophy? So in part of our company, we also do work for like internal large companies, a lot of them in the food space and the tech space, and their consumer insights, their like user insights teams. There's some on the UX side also, but really supporting their internal research functions with like presentations and data visualization and videos and stuff like that. So we get to see it. We've gotten historically to see a lot of it.
Mm.
And I've found we've seen a lot of segmentations from name big companies. And I found that like where they have struggled the most, and I think tech companies are behind the food companies in terms of research capabilities and really understand their consumer, to be honest. But where the top of the line kind of like food and like insights teams struggle, it's like, you know, okay, cool. We paid a lot of money to get a segmentation. We understand the buying personas, and we have all this data around them. But like, why do we? And then you know, a VP of marketing or the CMO like looked at it and they're like, why do we have 15 personas? Like, there needs to be prioritization. We can't, you know, like we need to be putting, you know, the, like. We need to be putting resources against the most highest ROI personas. What are those? Why are you even showing me number 10 at all? You know what I mean? So how do you even think about persona development in terms of like the number of them? And I know it varies depending on the case, right? But are you trying to narrow it down to one? Like, is it completely variable depending on the product? Like, how do you think about that?
Yeah, for my clients, typically it's very rare that they only have one. But to me, it's more about this understanding how they make decisions together. So in the decision-making committee or buying committee, decision-making unit, however you want to call it. So for me, it's important to understand who is the check signer, so who actually pays the check, right? Who's the manager that like supervises? Who's the influencer and who's the daily user? So those are kind of the four kind of archetype or types of users. And then maybe I have at least one persona under each. Sometimes can be two or three, but I wouldn't go more than three, four per type of user, right? And for early stage startups, I work with a company recently, wasn't early stage, but they got acquired by a private equity. So we basically needed to redo the whole marketing almost from scratch, even though they weren't at the early stage step. But in that case, since we still kind of wanted to validate the new go-to-market strategy, what we did was just have two personas. We had the value seeker, which was kind of the business buyer, and then the IT guy, which is what we call it, the technical buyer, basically. So like two simple personas. And from then on, once you start putting messaging out, then you can refine and narrow down to or expand into multiple different personas. But I would look at what stage you are in and try to at least cover as many as possible of those four user types. So who pays the checks, who manages, who influences the decision, and who uses the product.
That's exactly why I asked, because I think what you did there by identifying two, maybe it's not one persona, but you can't build a corporate vision. You can't build a tone of voice. No. You can't build campaigns
on 15
around eight personas.
It's ridiculous.
You know what I mean? Like, you're either dealing with a kid, you're either talking to a kid who is, you know, in his early to mid 20s, that is a developer that loves, you know, whatever, nerding out on GitHub. Or you're talking to a 55-year-old millionaire that is, you know, half checked out and really just, you know, like, like, you kind of have to understand, like, it has to be narrow.
Yeah, how you talk to both of them.
Yeah.
Right. And now, especially, if you're selling, it's different maybe a little if you're selling soda. And I think as AI, as you scale AI and you're able to customize messaging for everybody, maybe that changes. But that's really just the way you're reaching out directly with individualized communications. That's not even that's not like you're an overarching campaign or like what is this the corporate tagline. You know what I mean? Like, you can't have 12 personas in mind as you build a corporate tagline. You know, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, especially because like if I think about my work and the way that I create messaging, value propositions, for one single persona, I might have, I don't know, 8 to 10 different value propositions, each with its own pain points, implications, solution, jobs to be done. So do that for 15, it becomes quite complex to manage, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, but that's what I just noticed so many times, and even talking to clients about it, you know, it's like the researchers want to present all of their research because it was robust and they spent a lot of money and time and thought. And so here's the 15 seconds.
They give it all, yeah.
Right, but that's not what an enterprise needs, you know? But so I was kind of curious what your experience was.
Yeah, totally. I think probably the only, like, maybe change or thing that I'm starting to pay attention to now is since Google announced their AI mode, which is basically their new search where they hyper personalize everything is based on your personal experience. In that case, maybe if I have like a CMO persona, I might try and identify, okay, what are maybe two or three different variants of this CMO persona, and maybe have them in my documentation so that I can keep them into account and see which one hits the best or works better, right? There might be different facets that we can try and test and put out for.
Speaking of Google changing their search user experience, how deep, I take it you've been deep into SEO in your career, but how deep have you been into SEO, and how much have you been following kind of what's going on with optimizing for LLMs, LLM search, and yeah, like, where is actually, that? How much expertise do you have in that space?
Yeah, actually not that much, because my, like, the copy that I write is mostly conversion copy, so website copy, emails, sales deck, so anything that's close to the conversion. But I also sometimes clients ask me, hey, so how do you keep SEO into account? And what I tell them is, when you actually think about the modern SEO, like, what they mean is actually, hey, are you stuffing keywords in your copy? But that's not how the current SEO works, right? If you think about Google's what's it, EEAT, experience, expertise, like that acronym. When you do copy messaging strategy the right way, starting from solid research, understanding the whole customer journey, jobs to be done, the progress, I think the copy that you write basically keeps into account a lot of that EEAT framework stuff. And obviously, we are not replacing SEOs for the technical part, but I think we help SEOs a lot in terms of writing copy that's very human friendly, but also helpful for the search experience in making the content findable and searchable.
So most of your stuff is, like you said, conversion based. So websites, emails, and I guess ads as well.
Not really.
Talk
ads.
To us
website.
About like what you're doing, yeah, and how that's, yeah, what your thoughts are on those deliverables.
Yeah, so typically website copy, emails could be email sequences, onboarding emails, or a lot of sales decks, sales collateral. So we might create different sales decks for different personas, for example, or for every kind of meeting, every stage for the sales team. And that's why collaborating with sales team from the beginning, from that research, is fundamental, I think. So you kind of sync from the get-go. For the website aspect, what I do, and what I was mentioning at the beginning, is a lot of the UX user experience work as well, because I'm a firm believer that unless your copy is easy to consume, even if it's great copy, it's not going to convert. So I pay a lot of attention into actually laying out the copy, the flow, in a way that the narrative actually makes sense. It's super clear, frictionless. I create wireframes that then I pass to designers and developers. So those are basically like a skeleton of the website. And in my work, I also work on optimizing the navigation as well. So a lot of them, I think of the navigation as message, part of messaging as well. Because if you think about it, especially in B2B, when you have a lot of use case pages, persona pages, people, when they land on a website, if you look at user testing, the second or third action that they take is hovering on the navigation and seeing, okay, like, do they have a page for me? Is this the place where I need to be? And what's the next action they need to take?
And is it intuitive that they do have a place for me?
Exactly. And so for me, it's really important to understand the whole experience behind consuming the copy, from landing to going to the second destination, to accomplishing each of the micro decisions that they need to take on a website.
Chris, Corey and I have this little friendly argument all the time about when we're writing copy, how much do we focus on us, our company, and our capabilities and our services, and how much do we focus on the needs of the customers and anticipate what they are looking for? Where do you think the balance is?
Yeah, great question. I think the balance is, I always try to frame it in terms of customers. So the classic control F to search for the times they use we versus us or against you or yours. I try to be as customer focused as possible, but obviously sometimes you have to speak about yourself, right? So what I like to do is speaking about yourself, but in terms of having a strong point of view, which means having kind of an insight that you can use, that even if you're speaking to your customers in terms of like we help you or like you can do this, this is your benefit, they interpret it from a point of view of these guys know something that other people, other competitor haven't told me. So I need to pay attention because they have a very strong point of view. So that's how I think in terms of speaking about yourself, but customer focused, is having a strong point of view, the strong insight that differentiates you from what other companies do or how they see the market or product.
What, Chris, can you talk to us a little bit about, to the extent you're willing to share, trade secrets? How comfortable would you be to talk about like what AI tools you're using and where do you see them? How do you see them evolving?
Totally. From the start, as I mentioned, one of the first ones for research, I use Gemini, and that's where I share a lot of the research.
Gemini deep research?
No, actually, just now the 2.5, just a normal model, which is the one with the biggest context that it has. Sometimes I use deep research. I use mostly for content, to be honest, for now. Like write my own content, like doing research. But I like relying on my own kind of human guided research, so interviews, surveys, and all that stuff that obviously I use AI to produce as well. But so Gemini is a big one. I use Claude at the kind of the second stage to start writing some stuff, some of the strategy documents, just because I think Claude is one of the best at writing more humanly. Obviously giving
what do you think about the new what do you think about the new Claude model? What is it? Four? I don't even
the
four, know what number it
four
is.
One. Yeah, I think it's four. Pretty good. Yeah. I tried it.
Wildly good or just pretty good?
Compared to the 3.7, which was the one that was before, I didn't see a huge jump, but I think it's a bit better at interpreting more data and coming up with better insights from the get-go rather than having to go through iterations. So maybe it's a bit smarter. I don't know. But yeah. The only problem that I stumbled on with Claude was that you reach the limit pretty fast unless you have, I don't know, the pro plan or whatever. So what I do with my team, I use another tool that's called TeamGPT, where that's basically plugged on the Claude's API or also ChatGPT API. You can plug it with any API, I think, of the most popular models. And that's pretty cool because we can collaborate with the same chats. We can have a project for one client, project for another client. Inside, we have different chats where we actually write the copy or brainstorm on stuff. And so that's pretty cool because we have the same documents. So we write from the same point, from the same standpoint, right? And I could literally give access to one of those chats to my clients and they could almost write the copy that I write, which I'm kind of thinking as in turning into a product, we'll see. But or maybe using a GPT or something like that. I still have to try because ChatGPT is not as good, I think.
And then I know Claude has a team functionality that so Corey and I will just share GPT, I guess, chats, and I can add to his, but I don't think he can see. And I know there's a team functionality on Claude that we didn't get, but it sounds like you're saying there's like an API to do that for us. Because I think it's the next level of Claude that I just didn't want to invest in.
Yeah, TeamGPT, it's like a completely separate app. And you inside the app, you can plug to the Claude's API. So you pay, obviously, tokens by response. But like compared to like for the work that I get and the scale, like even paying that extra, it's not that much for me. So I think it's pretty valuable. There's another one. I don't know how it compares, because I only tried it for myself. It's called Typing Mind. And that's kind of the same thing. It works with all APIs of all different tools. So you can plug it, you can try different tools. They have a team plan as well, so you can work with someone else. You can create prompt libraries, all this stuff. So those are pretty handy. And I use ChatGPT, I have to say, mostly internally. So I like one extremely useful feature that only ChatGPT has. It's the memory feature, I think, especially now that it can look up all the other chats, because I don't have to repeat myself all the time. And I know that you, in Claude, you can do projects with all your project knowledge. But I don't know, I find it quite limiting, the fact that it's still limited to certain documents. And also there's a size, a maximum size of upload that you can have. Mm-hmm. So I find ChatGPT super helpful and super fast. Was yesterday that it's been down for a morning? It was a bit of a crisis. But yeah, typically it's pretty good. So yeah, I would say mostly Gemini, Claude, ChatGPT, TeamGPT, Perplexity sometimes for some research. Perplexity is pretty good if you want to research on Reddit or social communities to get some voice of customer, just because it's got the actual, you can actually select search for social and it looks up on Reddit threads, which contains,
oh, that's cool.
contains just a lot of voice of customer.
Does it have,
it used to be that you could literally select Reddit. Now, I think, now they only have search, which I think maybe because they improved it. And so you can literally search, so you can select web, academic research, social, or finance. So if you select social, I don't know exactly where it looks, but I'm sure that it looks up Reddit.
But doesn't ChatGPT deep research and Gemini deep
even
research?
Even normal ChatGPT does Reddit and socials. Like I put a bunch of beauty products in there and I always get like reviews.
Yeah, the only thing, I think Perplexity is a bit better. I don't know why specifically for Reddit, just because it was built for that, I think, from the get-go. And so if you want to look up specifically Reddit, which I do a lot of times for voice of customer, for that, I don't know how or why, but it's really good. It goes much more in detail than ChatGPT, I found.
Have you used Grok for Twitter conversations?
I've done a couple of deep researches, like just personally to try it, but not really. Have you guys?
No, but I imagine
we haven't really needed it.
Yeah.
Right.
I imagine
if you want to do reviews and kind of voice of the customer and you want to get deep into X, probably Grok is your doorway, I would imagine.
I'm gonna have to try it. I was saying, for deep research, what I found the best so far is actually Gemini, though. Yesterday I created a 40 page document. I tried the same deep research search with all the models, and Google Gemini was the best one so far.
Yeah. Interesting. So where do you see, I guess we're wrapping up here relatively soon, but where do you see, how do you think about this, right? I mean, it seems like we're on a trajectory that who knows where we're going to end up being, but the only way to survive in the medium or short term, there is no visibility in long term, is to be at the cutting edge of these things, right? To utilize them, to build products around them. And that's it's not even cutting edge, right? It's like everyone's doing it. So like, how do you square all that? Like, where do you see this going? What does your medium term look like?
I think, like, speaking personally in terms of like being a copywriter, messaging strategist, I think our role going forward will be probably less and less about writing and more about architecting, orchestrating these tools and kind of using them in like more efficient ways, but also still anchoring all the work in human insights. So as much human insights as possible, especially because the more we use AI, the more there you find this kind of cannibalization, the more AI content is put out that is not rooted in human insights or human thought, the more the internet is going to be flooded with crap AI content. And so the companies...
I think we're there already.
just look at LinkedIn. So the more you start from the roots and actually a proper process, a proper strategy, and real human research and insight, I think the better you will be able to differentiate and use AI for the scale, for the efficiency, and for the operations.
Yeah, not to get too dark, but the thing that I found the most profound, that I forget where I heard it first, but the idea that, like, even UX, you know, with agentic AI and the explosion in AI agents and the explosion in AI content, it's like 5 years from now, everybody's going to have 500 agents that are going to be doing all of their, like, the internet is going to be basically a place where agents are going to go to access data.
Yeah.
And so, like, you're, even the UX, the idea of human-centered AI, it may end up being, sooner than later, AI-centered AI, you know what I mean?
We need to do another podcast with, yeah, like, AI Corey, AI Chris, and AI Elisa.
Yes. Yeah.
We've talked could all about have that. A conversation.
With our avatars.
Well,
right. Yeah, it's a great point.
Yeah,
because
the
I was
idea
actually,
of human-centered AI is, yeah, is fascinating, but it's, yeah, how long, you know?
Yeah, I was actually thinking, now that they are launching all those computer control, that basically the models can control the computer, they can go around and do stuff. I was saying, because to me, one of the longest processes, kind of hardest processes to go through, is still like watching usability testing videos or message testing videos, because they're quite long, might take a lot of time. So what if we can also simulate users through AI kind of bots that use your website? Obviously, you have them wear the shoes of your personas. You have them go through your website. You basically record the AI going through the website and maybe even speaking to you. And yeah, it would be pretty cool. The only
thing—that's cool.
We are constantly populating again the internet with more AIs and AI. So I don't know how good that is.
And that's what you're talking about, is watching the AI step into the shoes of a human navigating a website.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, how long are human beings gonna need to go on travel websites and book their travel, you know, arrangements?
Yeah.
Like, it's just gonna be agents. It's gonna be. The AI is going to need to have the path to purchase of an AI.
You need to do user testing with AI agents.
Exactly.
Like, how would you, as Corey's agent, book this trip?
That's literally where we're heading. Like,
soon,
probably tomorrow.
Soon we might have to start persuading AI and agents rather than persuading humans.
Well, that's what they're already talking about, the search optimization for LLMs, right?
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what we're talking about.
Yeah,
it's dark, but listen, the only way to continue to make a living and to thrive is to be at the cutting edge of it. You know?
Use it.
There's no,
use it in practice.
Yeah, because everybody else is going to do it, and it is doing it. So,
yeah.
Thank you so much, Chris. This is fascinating. It's so fun. This is like, if we all went to coffee, this is basically everyone overheard our conversation.
Exactly.
Because this is like how we talk.
Awesome. Yeah, I loved it.
But it's been awesome having you and hearing like your point of view on. I really love everything that you've said about like that human aspect, because I think that that's something that we're going to all kind of take a step back and look at, like, how does that, the ebb and flow of humans with AI and agentic AI, like, what does that actually look like? And it seems like you're really grounded in that, you know, the human side of it, the empathetic, as you have said before.
It's still a thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Totally. Yeah, the more you read LinkedIn posts, the more you actually start to understand how the AI writes, and the more it makes you want to completely discard and rewrite it yourself.
For sure.
Oh,
yeah.
That's my personal experience you just explained. Like, that's like been me this week, actually. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Chris. It's great to meet you.
B2B Creatively is powered by Stories Bureau. This episode was produced by Alexandra Uresta with help from Mather Dillian. It was engineered and mixed by Tim Ballant and edited by Joshua Ramsey. If you like what you hear, go follow Stories Bureau on LinkedIn, where Elisa, Corey, and the rest of the team are dishing out tips all week long. Or maybe check out storiesbureau.com. Sign up for our newsletter, and that'll keep you up to date on all the latest trends and best practices in the B2B creative, design, and marketing worlds. Oh, and of course, follow us on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform to get more creative convos like this delivered straight to your feed every month. That's it for this one. So until next time, thanks for listening.